This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here with us again this Sunday. I don't think it matters where you are or who you are or even get the dogs and cats in, because I think this topic is really going to catch your attention. We're going to be talking with folks from the Innocence Project and the clinic here at the University of Virginia Law School and how you find and help those who are inaccurately found guilty and put in jail. Come out of jail, exonerate them. Let me thank those folks on Harrisonburg's 95.1 for listening today, and thank the folks at Dixon Disposal for supporting WNRN. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce your household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can help keep our planet green for years to come. And with Dixon, there isn't any sorting or separating. You can put trash in one can, and they do the rest. Dixon also offers single-stream recycling. For more info, it's DixonDisposal.com or 434-978-2111. All right, let's introduce our guests. Let's see if I can push all the right buttons today. Here on one side, Deidre Enright, Director of Investigation for the Innocent Project Clinic here at UVA.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for being here. Next over, Matthew Engel. He's a legal director at the Innocence Project Clinic.
Good morning, Rick.
And here on the far side, tucked in the corner, I guess because he's the student, is that right?
That's right.
Wes Bowling from the UVA Law School and a participant in the clinic.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate everybody for coming in. All the sounds are good. So thank you to Sean McCord. All right, so let's start. Tell everybody, what exactly is the Innocence Project?
We started our clinic in 4 years ago at the law school, and we're a branch of the Innocence Project Network, which was started in New York by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. And now, every year, several more pop up all across the country, and we popped up 4 years ago at the law school thanks to the dean asking us to start a project there.
All right, first off, statistics. Give me some statistics. I want people to find out the number of people that you believe to be improperly incarcerated and the number of people that the Innocence Project has currently released.
The numbers change all the time. This morning I went on the New York Innocence Project's website to see what the latest number is, and they're up to 278 exonerations at this time.
Over how long?
Since the project was founded.
See, and there you go. You turn away. Keep talking into that microphone.
Sorry about that. Since the project was founded, I don't know what year the exoneration database goes back to. The important thing to keep in mind, though, about those numbers that are posted on the National Innocence Project's website is that almost all of those are based on DNA exonerations. And we know from the fact that so many people who have had access to DNA testing in the years after their convictions have been exonerated that there are real problems in many of these cases. And what we are trying to do in our project, and a lot of projects are starting to think this way, is that it's important to start looking beyond just the DNA exonerations. If the error rate is as high as it has proven to be in DNA cases, there's no reason to assume that it's any lower in cases where there is no DNA evidence. And the simple fact of the matter is the overwhelming majority of criminal cases involve no DNA evidence whatsoever.
All right, stop for a second.
Sure.
You said... And see, now it's already jumbled in my head. What I heard made me believe that the people who are currently who have been exonerated were exonerated because of incorrect DNA. So state that over again. I got lost there for a minute.
it's not so much that they were exonerated because of incorrect DNA. It's because many of these convictions are very, very old, going back 30 years or even more in some cases, so that the DNA technology that we have today simply didn't exist at the time of these trials. And a lot of people were put away on non-forensic bases. One of the huge factors that puts people away is faulty eyewitness identifications. And people have then spent years, 20 years, 30 years in some cases, in prison based upon eyewitness identifications or other types of evidence. Jailhouse informants is another huge area of concern. What happens is that in these 278 cases, there has been biological evidence, material that is suitable for DNA tested, but that was never tested over the years. And part of the work that the Innocence Project does is to revisit these old cases and to seek that testing. And in those 278 cases, at least in the overwhelming majority of those 278 cases, when that testing has been done, the results have come back to exclude the individual who's been sitting in prison on the wrongful conviction. And those, so that's the testing that I was referring to.
Again, we are talking with folks from the Charlottesville, University of Virginia's, what's the proper word, group of the Innocent Project?
You could call it a chapter of the Innocence
chapter,
Project.
Thank you. The Virginia, the Charlottesville chapter of the Innocence Project Clinic. You can go online, innocenceproject.org, to learn more about it. For the national, on the overall scheme, there is a Charlottesville chapter website as well. Deidre Enright, Matthew Engel, and Wes Bowling. Wes, you're still a student at the University Law School?
Yes, I'm a third-year student. I was part of the clinic last year, and I worked on some of the cases that we've described, both DNA and non-DNA cases.
Now, did you do this out of the goodness of your heart, or was there credit involved in this? And you said, ooh, that looks good for 4 hours credit.
Well, there is credit involved. It is a classroom experience. It is a learning experience, and we're taught by two professors who are very knowledgeable in the field. But at the same time, I think the clinic draws students who are interested in helping others in the community and having practical experience during law school. And I know I, from my own experience, I worked with a lot of students who were certainly passionate about what they were doing.
All right, I'm going to come back in a minute and we'll talk about one of the cases that you worked on. But Deidre, why? Why do this at UVA? I mean, again, out of the goodness of your heart, or is there something more to it? Did you have some sort of flashpoint that made you or Matthew decide to do this? And again, I should be referring to you as Professor Enright and Professor Engel.
Yeah, Rick, thank you.
And
Let's stick with that. Once you earn those,
I mean, it's good.
I have to say that my flashpoint started many, many years ago. The very first case that I ever worked on as an investigator with a law firm in D.C. was a guy on death row in Texas. And the law firm had been approached by the ABA, the American Bar Association, to look into his case. And at the beginning, we thought our mission was primarily to spare him a death sentence. And after 2 years of investigation in that case in Texas, we discovered that he was the wrong guy. And we spent many years litigating and ultimately getting him released from death row. And that was just the accidental first case that I ever worked on. And it made me realize that I would have to go to law school and do that forever, because the odds of having the first case you ever work on be the wrong guy on death row struck me as something that had to be addressed, and not the goodness of my heart, which, if you knew me better, you would know doesn't exist.
Maybe by the end of the hour. Professor Engel, how about for you?
Actually, my background is also working on death penalty cases. I spent, after I graduated from law school in 2001, I spent a little over 6 years working here in Charlottesville at a nonprofit office called the Virginia Capital Representation Resource Center, which represents Virginia death row inmates in post-conviction habeas corpus proceedings, basically trying to help people who are already on death row. And after that, I spent about almost 3 years up in Northern Virginia at a trial office, the Capital Defender Office. office, which is appointed in death penalty cases. I knew Deirdre. We worked together back at the Resource Center days, and we had worked on several death penalty cases together. And certainly for me, I enjoyed working with her very much. And I was aware that she had started the program here at UVA, 4 years ago now. And when the opportunity opened up, she gave me a call, and we started talking about it. And it just seemed like too good of an opportunity to pass up. I know from the years of post-conviction work that I've done that there are huge flaws in the criminal justice system, and these cases really deserve a second look, some close scrutiny. And to be in a position now where we have the opportunity to do that, and we have the assistance of 12 incredibly energetic and talented and passionate law students each year to work under our supervision, was just incredibly appealing to me. And in the year and a half that I've been here working at UVA, it's been everything that I had hoped it could be.
And we'll get into that in a short bit about parts of the justice system that people, especially from the Innocence Project, believe need reform and other problems within the system. Wes, let's bring up a case that you were involved with so we can talk about a specific case. Give me a name, and I'll assume that the two professors will be familiar with that. So what are one of the cases that you worked on?
Well, last year, especially during the fall semester, the entire clinic, all 12 students, worked on the Justin Wolfe case. And I'm sure people in the community have heard about it. But in the summer of this year, we got a ruling from the judge that his convictions were actually overturned.
Well, let's not assume that people are familiar with it. So
right.
tell us a little bit about the case itself and how Justin Wolfe was put in jail.
Okay.
And then we'll get into how you exonerated him.
Well, around 9 years ago, Justin Wolfe was convicted of a murder for hire. There was no physical evidence presented against him, but the state did present the testimony of the shooter, Owen Barber. And at the trial, at Justin Wolfe's trial, the shooter claimed that Justin had hired him to kill the victim. And that evidence was presented with, some other testimony, circumstantial evidence. A couple of years later, after the trial, the shooter, Owen Barber, he recanted his testimony, and he stated that, he lied on the stand. He was encouraged, more or less, by the prosecution to do so because he wanted to escape the risk of the death penalty for himself. So once that happened, I think the Innocence Project and the law firm really got involved with that aspect of the habeas. And by the time it reached us, this was 2010, years after the recantation, it's at a different stage. It's already been up to the Fourth Circuit, where there was a ruling that Justin had a strong claim of actual innocence. And so that judge from the Fourth Circuit ordered all of these documents and police reports and interviews and tape interviews and all of this evidence that was never given over to the defense attorneys at trial. The judge ordered that to be given to Justin's defense team, and that's what the Innocence Project took. So in August of last year, we all 12 students took these documents, police recordings, witness statements, and just poured through them to look, to figure out what happened at the time. And again, this was all information that, because of Virginia's discovery policies, Justin Wolfe did not have any access to at all. And as it turns out, this is the information that proved up his innocence recently.
We are talking about the Innocence Project and the University of Virginia chapter here in Charlottesville. It's Wes Bowling, who is a UVA law student and a participant in the project last year. Professor Engel, how do you determine whose cases you're going to take?
That's a great question, and it's part of probably the biggest challenge of our job. We get so many requests for help, as you might imagine, once our names are sort of out there and prisoners are aware of our existence. they start reaching out to us for help, and we get anywhere from 12 to 15 letters a week, I would estimate, from inmates who are claiming wrongful incarceration, imprisonment, and asking us to look at their cases. A huge part of what we do is case screening, where we collect documents related to the inmate's case. We ask them to provide information about their case in the form of a questionnaire, and our students pore over those materials and try to help us determine which ones we should take. As of the last time I counted, we had 194 cases in our queue needing to be evaluated for whether or not we could take them. It's a huge number of cases, and it's something that we're constantly trying to stay on top of. But we do evaluate every case in which an inmate reaches out to us for help. I think one misconception that people might have about the cases that we take is that, you know, we're looking for sort of the most innocent people. Before we'll take a case, we have to be convinced that the inmate is innocent. That's what we're here to do, is to represent innocent people who are wrongfully convicted. But frequently there are cases where we will look at the facts of the case and be convinced ourselves that the person is innocent, but quickly come to the conclusion that the inmate has exhausted every legal avenue of relief that is available to them. So, you know, innocence is obviously a huge part of the criteria, but equally important is there anything that we can do for this person? Do they have the opportunity to file a petition for writ of habeas corpus, or a petition for writ of actual innocence, or a clemency petition to the governor? Oftentimes they've exhausted all of those opportunities before the case ever comes to us, and there's simply nothing left for us to do. So those are sort of the two criteria that we're looking at.
And I would like to add, in addition to working on in groups, so all of our 12 clinic students are on a group case, and they're teams of four. But in addition to that, they also look at the cases as they come in, and they each have an assignment of an individual case. So, you know, we have three cases that are being worked as group cases, then we have 12 cases that are being worked up as an individual case, and we've been extremely fortunate this year. We received some donations last year, so we have a little money that we are allowed to hire private investigators, and we have all the students that didn't get into the Innocence Project Clinic or want to act as volunteers, and there's between 50 and 75 of them in a group called the Innocence Project Volunteer Group, and they work with our private investigators, you know, looking over these cases as they come in as well. So we are actually looking into, you know, almost 20 cases at any given moment.
That's Professor Deidre Enright, who's the Director of Investigation for the Innocent Project. We also have Professor Matthew Engel from the Legal Director, Wes Bowen, who's a current law student. Let's go back to Justin Wolf for a minute. And Professor Enright, you were given materials, the recantation and some other work, years later. Why is this held for years? Does the system, whether it's police, whether it's attorneys, whether it's a judge, just want to keep their case closed because of percentages? I mean, why would you do this?
That's the great unanswered question in the Justin Wolf case. And it's part.
But it's not part, only the Justin Wolf case where you have similar circumstances of materials that would be important into determining actual guilt or innocence being held back. It's not just this one, right?
Absolutely. And it's driven by an issue that's unique to Virginia. Well, it's not unique to Virginia. Other states have this problem of open file policy. And Commonwealth's attorneys have an obligation to turn over Brady material, which is information that they would think is exculpatory to the defendant. You have a constitutional obligation to turn that over. Virginia does not have a mandatory open file policy, although most Commonwealth's attorneys' offices do have open file policy. And by that, they have a policy where defense attorneys can come in and look at everything that they have. This particular Commonwealth's attorney's office in Justin Wolf's case does not have an open file policy. So the world got turned on its head in Justin Wolf's case, and all that information that not only would have helped him to prove his innocence at trial, but probably would have prevented there being a trial at all. He had no access to that 10 years ago, but through the efforts of many, many attorneys, investigators over the years, a federal district judge finally, 10 years later, ordered that to be turned over, and then the case fell apart. Had they had it 10 years ago, there wouldn't have been a case.
Yeah. Can you tell us which Commonwealth Attorney's Office?
It's the Prince William County Commonwealth Attorney's Office. Actually, prosecutor is the he's been in that office longer than any prosecutor in the state of Virginia, and has put more people on death row than any other prosecutor in Virginia.
It is 11:20 here on the Wake Up Call as we talk about the UVA chapter of the Innocence Project, here with Professor Enright, Professor Engel, and Wes Bowling, who's a law student and a participant in that project.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And the Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. It's partly sunny today, highs in the upper 60s, mostly clear tonight, lows 45 to 50, a little lower in the valley and in Lynchburg. Partly sunny tomorrow. With highs 70 to 75 right now. It's a nice, fair, beautiful day in the valley. It's 59, 59 in Lynchburg, 57 in Richmond, 58 in Charlottesville. And let me thank L. Oppelman's for their support today. They are Central Virginia's complete music headquarters, continuously operated since 1890 at 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. L. Oppelman's music department now featuring acoustic guitars, banjos, mandolins, and violins, as well as electric guitar packages from Fender and PV. They also have complete drum sets. L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street in Lynchburg. Online, loppelman.com. All right, back with our guests from the Innocence Project Clinic and the UVA chapter. Professor Enright, it seems like that the more public that cases like Justin Wolfe bring about, that the less faith the general public would have in the system. Is that the case, or is it just sort of the, oh, well, I'm sure he's guilty about something? If they brought him to court, he's guilty about something, even though maybe they didn't find it about that. Because we are a very, I don't know, it seems that we don't want to believe sometimes. We're not a very hopeful society in the court system.
I guess everyone here would probably have a different answer to the question. I would have thought that 278 exonerations would result in me, the public, thinking, well, we have some problems that we have to fix. And I don't see a response in legislatures that that people are thinking, oh, we have to throw some money at this problem, which is ultimately what change always means, that you have to pay for the change. So just recently, there was a case before the Supreme Court about eyewitness identification. All of us know, and in particular psychologists are now proving, that we don't see what we think we see, and we're not as sure as we express that we are. But the idea of modifying our eyewitness identification procedures scares everyone so enormously because we've been relying on them for years. And so if we were to revisit those procedures and say we have to change them, it would cost a lot, and it would mean that all these old convictions have to be questioned. And it's not a place where it appears that we as a society want to throw our money.
Call up if you have a question or a comment for Professors Enright or Engel or Wes Bowling from the UVA Law School, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. If you need the toll-free, that's 877-WNRN-ROCKS. The local number, 979-0919. You talked about getting some donations to make this happen. Professor Engel, how much does it cost to redo a trial? I mean, if Justin Wolfe, from the moment that you chose his case until the end when he was exonerated, where does the money come from for that, and how much does it cost for that?
Well, I have to say Justin Wolfe was extremely fortunate to have a lot of resources at his disposal that the vast majority of inmates are never going to have for a number of reasons, one of which is that Justin, and this is bizarre to even say, but he was lucky enough to have been sentenced to death, which is... It sounds crazy when you say it, but the truth of the matter is, in Virginia and in many other places, you have no right to have lawyers appointed to help you unless you're sentenced to death. Because Justin was sitting on death row in Virginia, he had a right both in state court and in federal court to have lawyers appointed to look at his case. I don't know how much those lawyers got paid, but I know that it's very expensive to be appointing lawyers to be representing inmates in post-conviction procedures. Not only did Justin have court-appointed lawyers, he also had a law firm, King & Spalding, that took the case on, and he had us who took the case on and worked on it pro bono. We don't, you know, bill the court or bill the inmate for any of the work that we do. Part of the whole basis for having our Innocence Project is that most of the inmates who are sitting in prison, a tiny fraction of them are sentenced to death. Most obviously are not. And if you're not sentenced to death, unfortunately, you don't have a right to the appointment of lawyers to help you navigate the post-conviction process. And that's a huge void that we are here to fill. So we look for opportunities to take on cases where there aren't other lawyers who are going to be involved. And because we don't bill, it's a little bit difficult for me to put a price tag on the work that we would do. But
you know, you have four students minimum.
That's right.
Working how many hours during the semester?
You know, we tell our students it's kind of funny to anticipate working an average of 15 hours a week throughout the semester on their cases. Wes, you can probably say if that's accurate or not.
You can tell everybody how we lied to you.
Yeah, right. Only 15 hours a week is all you have to put in. No, I mean, I think the thing is students want to put in more time on this, and we're not even thinking about it from that perspective. When you get into these cases and you get involved and you start reading the facts and looking for these inconsistencies or, you know, a lot of the stuff we found last year, seeing that the prosecution withheld exculpatory evidence that would have helped prove the innocence, that sort of motivates you to keep working. So I think, you know, especially at the peak of going through all that discovery, you know, I know students that worked up to 40 hours a week just doing this case. So
In one class.
Yeah, we have other classes. That's right.
Yeah, Professor Ernight?
I was just going to say that, you know, DNA tests, that's, you know, for a standard DNA test, it's $1,000. That's what happens when you have a case that's all DNA. For these non-DNA cases that we really like to use to teach our students, it's mostly about hours and hard work. It's going places, it's going to courthouses, it's finding witnesses, which take forever. It's interviewing them. It's interviewing them a couple times because, unfortunately, people don't always come clean with what's really happened the first time you talk to them. So it's mostly about just doing the work. There's no secret other than hard work, really. Wes learned that the hard way.
979-0919 for a question or a comment. 1-877-WNRN. Rocks, if you need the toll-free number. We are talking about the Innocence Project Clinic and the UVA chapter with three guests from the Charlottesville UVA Law School. And let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for allowing us to be here today. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, where your happiness is their priority. At Blue Ridge, you can return gear and apparel purchases at any time for any reason. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road in Charlottesville and at three locations in Richmond. For more store information, it's brms.com. And let's take our first call for the day. We have Jim from Charlottesville. Jim, you with us?
Yes.
And your question.
Well, I actually have a comment. Going back to Professor Enright's observation that it may cost some money that we are unwilling to pay to improve the criminal justice system. And I think that's certainly accurate to say that, but there are some areas in which improvements can be made that don't really cost a whole lot of money, and I think it might be valuable for the listeners to know about that. I have two things particularly in mind. One is reform of discovery. I've been involved with some law groups working on discovery reform in Virginia. And there's a sense, although it can't be proved definitively, that improving discovery, defense discovery, can actually save money because you end up having fewer trials and using fewer judicial resources. So that's one area in which we can perhaps make improvements in our criminal justice system without a big price tag. The other is eyewitness identification, which has been mentioned on the show, obviously, a couple of times and is very important. In that area, police can be instructed on doing a double-blind identification procedures. And again, this can be accomplished without a great deal of additional cost or appropriation or funding. So I just wanted to add that to what's been said, that certainly there's a lot of room to improve our criminal justice system, but some of the steps that we can take might not end up costing a lot of money and therefore are very attractive in this climate of reduced government resources.
Hey, Jim, thanks for the call. Great points. We're going to jump into that right now. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And for others who want to call in, make a comment, ask a question, it's 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. Our guest today from the UVA chapter of the Innocence Project Clinic, Professor Deidre Enright, who's the Director of Investigation, Professor Matthew Engel, who's the Legal Director, Wes Bowling, who's still at the University Law School, but who took the class and participated in the project last year. Professor Enright, I heard you comment about in a positive manner to Jim's points.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with him, and I agree that open file policy for everybody, mandatory in all the counties, would be great, and it would. A lot of the bar groups have pointed out that if everyone knew all the same information at the outset of a case, the resolution of it could probably be handled much more efficiently and more quickly. And many police departments are moving towards what Jim, to the sequential and blind, double-blind eyewitness identification procedures. It's just not mandatory everywhere. And Matthew, you should probably talk about what that is. I don't know if everyone would be aware of what it means. You know, eyewitnesses are generally believe that when they're being shown photos, that the likely suspect is in that pile of photos. And that's just a presumption that you can't really get away from, even when you say to them, as police do, the person may or may not be in this lineup.
That's a lot of Law and Order episodes that we've watched, and that's how business is done, whether it's true or the best way or not. Professor Engel.
But what we know, and the caller put his finger on it exactly, is that we can improve the way that those lineups are done. And we have a colleague at the law school, Professor Brandon Garrett, who's done an enormous amount of work on eyewitness identification procedures. And one of the things Professor Garrett likes to say is that this is an improvement that we can make for the cost of 6 manila envelopes. And what he means by that is that this is an incredibly cheap reform. If you want to do eyewitness identifications properly, then what you don't do is what we've done for years, which is give the witness a piece of paper with 6 pictures on it and lead them to think that the person who committed the crime is one of those 6 people who are pictured there, and have it given to them by a police officer who already has a suspect and therefore may be giving, even involuntarily, may be giving cues as to which picture the witness ought to be choosing. The way to avoid that is to use what both Jim, the caller, and Deirdre were talking about, which is sequential and double-blind eyewitness identification procedures. Have the police officer who is working with the witness to make the identification not be an officer who has investigated the case and who has a suspect. Tell the witness that the person who committed the crime may or may not be one of the people who are pictured. And then rather than putting the pictures on a single sheet of paper, you give them individual pictures sequentially, so that rather than doing comparison shopping and picking the one person in the lineup who they think looks most like the person that they remember from the offense, they're actually looking at pictures one at a time and deciding yes or no, this is or is this not the person. And you can accomplish that very easily one of the complaints about this is that, you know, we would have to bring in different police officers, and we would have to, you know, people who weren't involved in this case bring in a different police officer to do the double-blind lineup. What Professor Garrett likes to say is you don't even have to do that, because you can just, if you take six mugshots and you put them in six different envelopes, six different manila envelopes, and you hand them over to the witness so that the police officer himself doesn't even know which picture the witness is looking at as any at any given moment, then there's no possibility of creating that bias, and the witness can go through them one at a time and say this is or is this is not the person. We know from the studies that have been done that that will result in much more accurate eyewitness identifications. We know from the work that the New York Innocence Project has done that eyewitness identifications are one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions. There's really no excuse, in my view, for not implementing these double-blind eyewitness identification procedures. It's cheap, and it works.
Again, thanks to Jim for the phone call and the comments. You can make yours here on the Wake Up Call, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks. Professor Deidre Enright, Professor Matthew Engel, and UVA Law School student Wes Bowling here talking about the Innocence Project Clinic and the UVA chapter. I don't understand why there isn't a mandatory open door policy about sharing information in Virginia. What can you tell me as to why that hasn't been forced by state law? What are the benefits of keeping it the way it is?
Well, in this case, the Commonwealth's attorney, Paul Ebert, just before we had our hearing, there was proposed legislation about mandating open file policy in Virginia. And his response as to why he did not want it was that he said, in his experience, defense attorneys use the information that's turned over to, quote unquote, fabricate a defense. And I guess the insinuation is that if defense attorneys had access to the information, it wouldn't be being used to prove innocence. It would be used to concoct red herrings that trick juries into acquitting people. Most Commonwealth's attorneys in Virginia don't think that, and they think that open file policy is preferable. Recently, there was some legislation or proposed legislation, and it ended up being unresolved, and I'm not sure exactly what happened, but they couldn't get the force of the bar behind it. That's what I know.
Wes Bowen, who's a participant in the most recent or last year's class for the Innocence Project here at the UVA Law School. If you take your thoughts along with those who you had other students, and you could make a change to try and reduce the number of wrongfully convicted individuals, what would it be?
I mean, we've talked about the open file policy. I think you asked whether that made sense to not have an open file policy. I mean, I just think of it kind of this way, you know. A criminal trial is about figuring out whether an individual defendant did something that's a crime or not, and whether he or she should be punished. I don't see why everybody involved in that doesn't have the most information, because information increases accuracy in anything you're doing. So to me, if we want accurate results, that's the only way to do it. So I would start there. I mean, other reforms, we've talked about, you know, cases where there are eyewitness testimony that is just wrong, and that's sort of a clear example of where, you know, continuing the trend of scientific analysis of how we approach things, being brave enough, you know, to say the way we've done things in the past is wrong and it leads to inaccurate results. You know, I think of politicians going to the polls and asking, you know, for police reform or something, and I immediately picture the opponent saying soft on crime and the voters saying running away and voting for the other guy. I think we need, as a society, need to be comfortable with the idea that you know, we, although there's this very important role that the criminal justice system plays, believing we have a perfect system is just is not the place to start. Is not good.
I hope Wes got an A in the class last year. And if
no comment.
We're not allowed to talk about that.
11:39 here on the Wake Up Call with our guests as we talk about the Innocence Project Clinic.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
And this week's issue, after seeking millions in tax credits to mitigate losses from a failed housing development turned state park, investors from Biscuit Run have filed a $20 million lawsuit with taxpayers as the target. The Hook looks into who's behind this idea and could it work. There's news on more local trials, case thrown out and charges dropped against James Hafferty's so-called stalker. The Hughley trial will have no TV in court, and a juror has issued a written critique of the judge who reduced the award in the Lester v. Allied Concrete case. And Roger Ebert reviews The Double, The Hook, conveniently located throughout the area. And let me thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support of WNRN. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, online, brgtshirts.com. And back with our guests today, Professors Enright, Professor Engel, and Wes Bowling from the UVA Law School, talking about the Innocence Project Clinic. You're welcome to call up with your question or comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Professor Enright, I want to talk a minute about, for many people, and we talked about at the very start of the hour, DNA. It costs $1,000 to run a DNA test, but it seems that it would be the easiest way to exonerate someone. But that's not all that the UVA chapter takes on. You can go to the website, the main website, innocenceproject.org, and it shows the case. It tells you a history. It tells you what they were charged with, how long they were in prison, and whether or not you found the true convict. What's the proper word that I want?
Perp.
That's a lot of Law and Order shows as well. But the Charlottesville chapter takes on or intentionally does work with non-DNA exoneration. I'd like to know the difficulty in that. And a couple of those cases, you have exonerated someone by not using DNA, but the real criminal hasn't been found. How do you do that? How do you convince the system that guy's wrong, but I can't tell you who's right?
Well, the evolution of DNA has made it a lot easier, because the defendant is not supposed to have the burden of proving what actually happened. Simply, he's supposed to simply prove that it wasn't him who did it. In our experience, in both capital cases and the cases that we do now, if you're claiming innocence, you're going to be the best off if you can at the same time point at the true perpetrator. And that's, I guess, why we think it's so important to take non-DNA cases, because we are inclined, I think, or more and more inclined as a society to accept the results of a DNA test. Although the Norfolk 4 case might belie that, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But there's DNA in only 10% of criminal convictions. So the 90% that are left are the ones where there's going to still be an error rate that probably matches the DNA cases, and that's why we look into those cases as well.
Well, there's a couple ways about ways to reform the system, and better forensic science, or I guess improper forensic science, is one of the problems. So how do you correct science that's wrong?
Well, I can. In one of our cases, we have a client who was convicted largely based on the fact that a shirt that the police found in his truck after the crime had hairs on it. And several of the hairs, an expert said, belonged to him. But they said this one particular hair on that shirt belonged to the victim, who was deceased. And back at the time that this case was litigated, microscopic hair comparison testimony was accepted in courts everywhere. And that's putting a hair under a microscope and looking side by side and saying, well, this looks like that could be his hair, and this looks like that could be her hair. Today, you wouldn't be allowed to present that kind of testimony, and what you would do instead is mitochondrial DNA testing, where you can exclude absolutely another person as a source. So we are going to move the court in that case to do the mitochondrial DNA testing on that hair to show that it didn't come from the victim. And the expert who testified at the time has signed an affidavit saying, yes, what I did then could no longer be done now, and the proper procedure would be to do mitochondrial DNA testing. So that case is sort of the learning curve of you have to advance with the science, right? That which was once accepted is now not, and we have to embrace that and move along. And our whole criminal justice system should do the same thing in all these spheres, right? We now know that eyewitnesses aren't what they used to be, and we should adapt. We wouldn't keep using junk science just because it's what we did then, and we should move everything forward like that.
Well, we talked about some of the problems with the system, eyewitness misidentification, improper forensic science, and there's a couple other on here. We'll see if we can get to false confessions, court-appointed attorneys. I guess bad lawyering was the way that I read that. What are the biggest hurdles, though, in making the exoneration actually happen? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what is the biggest problem in turning over the case?
Well, I could jump on what the case Deirdre was just talking about with the client who had the hair testimony used against him in court. I mean, we know now that this is bogus. You can't rely on it. I'll say that outright. And yet, it's up to the judge's discretion to grant this testing. I don't understand why there's not, a new procedure has been introduced proves it's not only accurate in and of itself, but it proves that the other procedure was inaccurate, and yet maybe the judge will decide that this shouldn't be tested, and so he'll just have to sit and find some other solution. So what's the problem that I kind of identify out of that? This obsession with the permanence of a conviction once it's reached. On the one hand, society needs to have faith that the people who are convicted of crimes are guilty, but having convicted them does not mean that they're guilty, especially when we have all this proof that there are inaccuracies in the system. So.
But aren't we supposed to believe that our judges and our jury system, that once the decision has been made, that we can have faith and go home at night that they have made a correct decision? And what we're being asked to do is to believe that they can make mistakes and maybe I'm not as safe as I thought I could be?
Well, I mean, the Innocence Project does never stand out or doesn't state, the entire system of judges and juries is flawed. We're looking at a lot of the techniques that prosecutors and police use to introduce evidence, to use the system. And they're using the system improperly and inaccurately, and that's what we're talking about.
Professor Engel, let's jump at that for a second, because one or two of the other things that are listed as problems with the system include false confessions. And that's a method used by police to convict someone. And what I gathered from Wes Bowling saying is that that's a method used that might possibly need to be discarded or certainly lessened in its accuracy.
This is another great example of what the caller was talking about, where we could introduce a cheap reform that would go a long way towards solving this problem. And the reform in this case would be videotaping all police interrogations. We don't at this time require all interrogations to be videotaped. The technology certainly exists. We can afford to do it. It's cheap. And I can't tell you the number of cases that we've worked on in which we watch partially recorded interrogations where our client, the prisoner, is maintaining their innocence for hours. Sometimes up to, we've watched videotaped interrogations that go on for 8, 10, 12 hours sometimes of the person staunchly maintaining their innocence. And then there's a break in the tape, and they go out for a cigarette break. And when they come back and turn the tape back on, the story's changed completely, and the inmate is now admitting culpability in something that they've been denying all along. And you have to question what was in that cigarette that they were outside smoking, because some radical change has taken place here. If we required all of the interactions between police and suspects to be videotaped, we would have a better sense of what's happening in interrogations. What we know from what we have seen of interrogations is that police routinely lie to suspects or to witnesses when they're interrogating them, so they can tell people, for example, who are maintaining their innocence, we know that you're lying because we have DNA that proves that you did it, even though there's been no DNA testing done. They can hook you up to a polygraph machine, a lie detector machine, and they can say the machine tells us that you're lying, even though a polygraph examination is utterly unreliable, and half the time the machine may not even be plugged in. They're not even actually giving the polygraph examination. They're just tricking the person that they're interrogating into believing that they're conducting, that they have some machine that's telling them that they're lying. And it's surprisingly easy to overcome somebody's will when you're able to lie to them and trick them and deceive them into believing that science says that you committed this crime. It is a huge problem. We're working on several cases involving false confessions, and it's another case where with a relatively cheap reform we could go a long way towards solving that problem.
I just wanted to add, people, this is one of the areas where a lot of people still say, oh, I don't think anyone would ever confess to something that they didn't do. Why would you ever say that you were involved in a murder or rape that you had nothing to do with it? That's ridiculous. But when you watch these interrogations, and it's often young people, it's often people who are mentally maybe not as strong or as smart as the general population.
A lower IQ score?
Often. And they are interrogated. They are told that they are known to be involved. It goes on forever. They all talk about how they think they're never going to get to leave or see their family. And then the final thing that's offered is, all you have to do is tell us, we understand this was a mistake, and you can maybe even go home. All you have to do is tell us the truth. So what they're being told that falsely is, you can end this whole thing and go home. All you have to do is say this, that you were involved. And of course, I don't think most people really are aware that you can be lied to like that. And then they think, well, gosh, I can go home, of course. So, yeah, whatever version of events you want, that's fine. I just want to go home. And there you have it, right? And I don't think most people have had that experience of being interrogated and then being offered the option of going home in exchange for a lie.
11:52 on the Wake Up Call, discussing the Innocence Project and the UVA chapter here with Professors Deidre Enright and Matthew Engel, as well as student Wes Boland from the UVA chapter here at the law school. Let me thank The Backyard for their support today. They are the UVA Corner's culinary secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue. The Backyard has a seasonal menu, daily specials, and a rotating list of beers on tap. Backyard now open on Sundays, serving brunch and then a pub food menu till close. For more information, you can call them at 202-8215. TheBackyardUVA.com, then they have a Facebook page. And my man Drew Thompson just walked in for Les Temps Perdue. Beginning at noon, they have the best of 80s and 90s alternative music with Dead Kennedys, Echo and the Bunnymen, and Big Audio Dynamite. Brought to you in part by Caliente. Requests are always welcome on Les Temps Perdue. All right, a question. Professor Wright, an attorney?
I'm sorry.
You are an attorney?
Yes.
Professor Engel, an attorney?
Yes, I am.
And Wes, learning to become an attorney.
That's right.
So you talk about, hopefully, you talk about things that shouldn't be allowed. Eyewitness misidentification. Forensic science can be wrong. The way that the police does false confessions, isn't that just the side that an attorney would take by representing their defendant? There's nothing wrong with these things. There's no problem in the system. It's defense attorneys trying to prove that their guilty clients are wrong, have wrongly been put away. There's nothing wrong with the system. It's the attorneys in the room who have a problem because their clients were found guilty.
Well, there are certainly 278 people whose names you can find on the Innocence Project website who would tell you otherwise. This has been the great accomplishment of Innocence Projects and of DNA testing, is that we know that the system is flawed. Frankly, some of us who have been practicing criminal defense law for years have known that all along, but what we now have is proof that the system, more frequently than anybody would like to admit, convicts the wrong person. The hard work that we have to do now is to reform the system to prevent these kinds of injustices, and also spend the money and spend the time to review the convictions that have already been obtained under these flawed methods. Nobody wants to see the wrong person sitting in prison, somebody who's innocent. And also, what we have to remember is that in every one of those cases where an innocent person is sitting in prison, there's a guilty person who hasn't been convicted of that crime and who could still be out on the streets. It's in everybody's interest, law enforcement, defense attorneys, prosecutors, the general public, to convict the right people. And that's exactly what we're talking about trying to do.
And I would also add, everyone agrees about these things. Everyone agrees that there are, you know, there's prosecutorial misconduct, there's ineffective assistance of counsel, there's bad eyewitnesses, there's junk science. Everyone agrees on that. It's just that most people think it didn't happen on their watch in their case and become very defensive when these things are exposed. And there's a district attorney in Dallas, Texas, who I think has, Craig Watkins, has sort of taken the appropriate position. And he was elected DA and immediately said, let's have an Innocence Project right here, and you can go through all my old cases. And he's helping the Innocence Project clear the old cases. They've exonerated, I think, more than 20 people. And I think that's just the way to go, is we make mistakes. We know we make mistakes, and we just have to be able to own up to them when they're exposed.
Sounds like we need more people like Mr. Watkins in our system. It is 11:56 here on the Wake Up Call. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. All right, so there's 278 people who have been exonerated. What happens after that? And the length of time, once you find that they are improperly found guilty, how long before they actually get out of jail, and what happens to them after that?
Well, Justin Wolfe is currently in solitary confinement as a result of being having his name cleared most recently. So I'm not sure.
Why in the world is he still in solitary confinement?
That's a good question. We were just in Norfolk.
That sounds like a lawsuit. Hey, I'm not supposed to be here, and I'm still being held here?
That's exactly right. I mean, we were in court the other day, you know, and Justin testified, and so did the director of the Department of Corrections.
Stupid stuff like that gets me all worked up.
Yeah.
All right, so back to the question, as I've distracted you. So you found someone who's been proven innocent who is still in jail. And how long ago? You said last summer?
Yeah, last summer.
So a year.
Yeah.
More than a year later, he's still in jail.
Yeah. He's still in jail.
Well, he's not just on death row. Yeah,
no,
he's been moved into worse conditions as a result of having all of his convictions and sentences vacated.
And that's because of the judge, the state?
The Department of Corrections maintains that it's the only place that they can protect him while the appeal is pending.
Lord. And so what happens, hopefully,
to your answer, I mean, the order that clears Justin's convictions, and it is up for appeal potentially, so it's going up to the Fourth Circuit. That's the state's move. The judge ordered him released within 120 days of last summer, and that day is coming up. So I think, you know, it's a question of whether the state decides to retry him or what the Fourth Circuit does on appeal.
And more generally to your question, there's actually a wonderful film, a documentary called After Innocence, and you can stream it on Netflix, and everybody should watch it, because it's a story about how, even once you can prove somebody's innocence and get them out of prison, how their lives are affected forever, and that we can never truly undamage that a wrongful conviction does. So it's well worth a watch.
And last question. We are down to our last bit of time here with our guests, Professor Deidre Enright, Professor Matthew Engel, and Wes Bowen from the Innocence Project Clinic at the UVA chapter. you're queuing a handful, or actually queuing many, over at the UVA Law School. Have you determined who may be next? Selected next for the class to work on?
Yes, but we're not going to tell you, Rick.
I hear that a lot in my life.
We're currently working on many cases that we're moving towards litigation and evaluating many more. We do have a sense of the which cases are coming up next, but you know, it's an ever evolving process.
And now that we've talked about the Innocence Project as what it does, will you come back and we can talk about a variety of cases and how particular individuals have been wronged?
Absolutely.
We'd love it. Any day.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Our guest today, Wes Bowling, a UVA Law School student, Professor Matthew Engel, who's the legal director for the Innocence Project Clinic, and Professor Deidre Enright, who's the director of investigation. Thank you all for what you do, and I hope that Justin Wolf gets out soon, and I hope that many other people are found for the innocence they deserve.
We do, too. Thanks for your support.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Next week, someone, although I don't know who, will be here to represent the Occupy Charlottesville group and talk about what is going on and what they're going to do next. Up next, Les Thames-Perdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.